Welcome to The Geek in Review, the podcast focused on innovative and creative ideas in the legal industry. I'm Marlene Gebauer.
And I'm Greg Lambert. So Marlene, we are jumping into a topic this week that I know that I love to talk about, and that's, you know, any chance I get a chance to talk about comic books, I'm going to talk about it. If I get a chance to talk about AI, I'm going to talk about it. And we get to blend those together and really kind of see how each of them can kind of relate and work together in the creative process.
Yeah, I'm really looking forward to this one. You know, we even got like special prizes, you know, in the mail.
Yes.
in relation to this podcast. So
that's true. So this week we have Roger Skalbeck, who is professor of law at the University of Richmond Law School. Ashley Dobbs, professor and director of IP and Business Transaction Clinic at the University of Richmond Law School. And Chris Kostanova, AI consultant and author of Zyra of the Dawn comic book. So Roger, Ashley, and Chris, welcome to The Geek in Review.
Hello.
Hello.
Great to see you. Wonderful to join the conversation.
So gang, we're going to talk about art, copyright, comic books, and AI. Are these four things that can coexist, or is there always going to be a conflict as these pieces overlap? Roger, Let's start with you and talk about your 50-copy run of Section 101 of Title 17 comic book. Talk to us about this, and I mean, it is amazing. It is so beautiful. Talk to us about this comic book. You know, why and how did you create it?
That's great. I'm really happy to join the conversation and talk about it. The origins of this go back to October, November. I was preparing a talk with our local CLE IP group about the kind of emerging issues of artificial intelligence and intellectual property. And so I was looking into some issues and was able to find a lot of good examples as to what was going on. And one of the stories that I discovered was the Zarya of the Dawn example, where at the time that I was researching it, everybody was excited because AI had been used to create this product, and it was registered as a copyright. Then as things go on, I find that then the story changes, and we'll get to the evolution of what that looks like, because the author is here, which will be great to hear about. And what I read in that was, a lot of it was that the Copyright Office needed better examples as to how things were created and also what was submitted to them for that. So I was like, you know, I want to do something about this. And I thought, you know, what I want to do is actually start using some of these tools to express my own interests and kind of my own subject areas. The first idea was I was going to do a poster. So I was going to do a poster, and it was going to be the Fantastic Four factors. I was going to talk about fair use and things like that. And I thought, this is going to be great. And I started using Midjourney to do all this stuff. And then I realized that's more of a trademark issue, and that might muddy the waters as to what was going on. And I thought also, fair use is, that's further in the copyright statute. Why don't we start at the beginning and sort of the origin story? So I decided, let's do Copyright 101, which is literally the section where all the definitions are. I teach copyright, which I've done since 2019, and this is a place that we look to understand what exactly copyright is, and I'm always bringing the students back to it to say, what is the language of the statute, and how have courts done something about it?
Yep.
So what I did then is basically created a comic book that's almost every single definition of that set up in alphabetical order and put it together as a narrative and a story about the law and included the law within it.
Well, it's very beautiful. Can you just describe it a little bit for us?
I'll give you some copies of this too. So the best way to describe it is what I tried to do in putting this together before I'd done any image creation is I wanted something that looked like the comic books that I grew up with. The Avengers, the Spider-Man, the kind of things that would show the heading across the top where we have the comics code and things like that.
Yeah.
So I wanted something that was like in the style of Jack Kirby and Chris Claremont and kind of the classic superheroes that I had. And a nice Technicolor feel to it and sort of, I'm not really low res, but sort of a simplified aesthetic. So every single image within this has a really bright, vibrant color that sort of I tried to create so it jumps off the page and really really portrays the actual text of each individual definition in the statute. Yeah.
Well, you did a great job.
How did you get it made? What was the process for that?
Oh, great. And this actually is listed in the back of the title page of it. So the tools that I used were, I used Midjourney for the original image generation with iteration after iteration of images. I used a lot of Photoshop and Pixlr to update it. And then what I did was I put it together with a relatively simple program called Comic Life 3. And I think Chris has used this one as well. And it's a layout program a little bit like Microsoft Publisher. Kind of old school. It's kind of simple. But what you do is you set up a layout of how many images you want on this page. Then you import each of them and annotate them. And then in terms of printing, there's some nice online print shops that do comic printing. That's a nice full bleed approach to things. And you set up the number of pages and the style of paper you want and all those kind of things.
Very cool. I'll have to check that out.
Yeah.
Because,
I mean, that looks professional. I mean, yeah, I was just blown away when I saw it in the mail.
Yeah, and initially it was going to be an 8.5 by 11 layout, which was the easiest thing to do. I printed a version, I showed it to someone, and the response was, that's not a comic.
Yeah.
Comics are a very specific size, and there's evolution of sizes over time as to the small, medium, and the U.S. and things like that. So I wanted something that really kind of fit the mode and was of the time of the things that I was trying to emulate. Yeah.
Well, you did a great job on it. I have my copy prominently displayed here in my office. So.
Me too.
So, Ashley, you run the IP and Transactional Law Clinic there at Richmond Law School. Talk to us a little bit about what kind of work you're having the law students do there at the clinic. And as I was prepping for this, and Roger and I were shooting some emails back and forth, I understand Roger may be a client as well of the clinic.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, no, thanks for having me. I'm happy to talk about the work we're doing. And I should preface this that Roger, who is a client of the clinic, has waived his attorney-client privilege rights.
Well done.
In order for me to talk about his project with you. So the IP and Transactional Law Clinic is an opportunity for law students, mostly third-year law students, people in their last year of law school, some in their second year, to work directly with clients on those kinds of matters under the supervision of a licensed attorney, me, and to start to bridge from the doctrinal, the book learning they've gotten in law school to actually applying it to clients, but without being in the crucible of a law firm right off the bat. We try to work with people who can't otherwise afford legal services, and we look for interesting projects in all kinds of realms, but we tend to work with startups, entrepreneurs, makers, creators of all kinds who are coming to us wanting to protect various kinds of intellectual property, mostly copyright and trademark. Sometimes we will do, we've delved a little bit into trade secret. We don't do patents since it's for a variety of reasons, but we might let a client know and refer them to some local practitioners that do patent work. But we also end up doing a lot of the transactions related to that. So somebody will come to us and say that they want to register a trademark. And then we ask a few questions. And the next thing you know, we are forming an entity, providing the organizational documents and the bylaws or the operating statement, reviewing the contract with whoever helped them create their logo, or perhaps creating a contract with whoever created their logo to assign the rights, taking a look at perhaps if copyright protection might also be warranted, as it is in many cases. And as well as the trademark work, and then various other transactional matters that entrepreneurs might need.
The big takeaway I got from that is Roger can't afford an attorney. So
I will sometimes make exceptions for people who could afford an attorney if they bring me a really cool project.
Well, Roger, thanks for waiving your attorney-client privilege on this.
Happy to waive those rights.
Yep. You can do it. So, Ashley, I also understand you do some other interesting work. Roger mentioned something about there's an improv group, something with them.
Ooh.
And Elvis. Can you tell us a little bit about that? I don't know if they've waived their right yet, but...
Oh, no. But if you're ever in the D.C. area in January, you should check out Elvis's Birthday Fight Club.
Oh.
Wow.
They also have shows in Maryland. It's usually on the anniversary of the man's birth date. It was delayed this year due to COVID. So they, and it was on hiatus during COVID. So in 2023, it actually, I'm sorry, 2022, it actually took place in August. So they do a hilarious, hilarious burlesque show that has it modeled on Fight Club, emceed by someone who is not Elvis and is possibly an impersonator, but might be an impersonator of his ghost. But the toilet.
Oh, no.
The toilet is a key figure.
Yeah. That is funny, yet sad. That's it. I'm surprised they let you talk about it because.
Well, because, you know, that's the first rule of Fight Club, right?
Yeah. And the second rule, I hear.
And the second rule, like, don't talk about Fight Club. Yeah, so we try not to talk about this too much because Fight Club is taking full advantage of their rights to parody public figures and creative works under the fair use exception to the Copyright
Act.
Very cool.
All right, so we're going to scale it back from Elvis, and we're going to talk about copyright again. So, Ashley, the U.S. Copyright Office last week came out with a clarification of how it's going to handle issues of AI-generated artwork and what is and what is not covered. So can you walk us through what the current guidelines say?
Right. So the current guideline, but by the current guidelines, I'm assuming you mean what they said before
Correct.
They issued this. Yes. Okay. So there's no mention of AI artwork. What right now, the current guidelines of how you register, I mean, there is a mention of it, but not as explicit as in this guidance. So currently, when you register a work, there's the things that you authored, and there's the things that you are claiming, and sometimes what you're claiming includes stuff, elements that are not copyrightable or are not claimable. Wow. So, for example, if you create an illustrated map of the United States and you start out with a map that was issued by the U.S. Geographic Services, you know, the USGS, and that's in the public domain, you have to identify that you're not claiming authorship in that underlying public domain work. You're not claiming it at all, not just claiming authorship. And you have to say include that in your description of excluded materials, and which then begs the question of what is included. And so you're supposed to provide a short statement of what is included. Now, so examples of things that aren't claimable are the example I just gave you of public domain materials, but also too previously published material. So let's say I'm doing a derivative work. I'm doing a revision of a book that I wrote before. I have to identify that this current claim does not include the previously published work or the previously registered material, but only the new stuff, the new elements that I'm including. And typically the explanation is a very short description. Excluded materials, previously registered text. Included materials, text, right? So it's pretty straightforward like that. And if you go to the compendium on the Copyright Office's website, it gives examples of how to do this and gives these short explanations. But it also tells you if there is work included that's uncopyrightable, so for example, short terms, short phrases, facts, figures, you do not have to explicitly exclude that because it's a given. So... if in your mind, what you're putting into the copyright application is wholly yours and nothing's excluded because it either falls into uncopyrightable elements or because you are claiming it, there was never a place to write a dissertation or a lengthy explanation of what you're including and why you're claiming it and why until they asked you about it. And they're not going to assume anything. It's not... If you don't exclude something or if you don't claim something, they don't make any assumptions about what you meant or what you intended.
All right. So, and then with the new clarifications, have they struck a balance or are we still unclear about what they'll do when, you know, Roger goes to file copyright protection?
Well, you know, we're still taking a look at what they issued and sort of analyzing it. At first glance, I feel like what we included for Roger's claim is within the spirit of what they're suggesting, in that we disclose that AI was used as a tool and we identify the elements of human authorship. They have some specific requests where, like, don't name the tool that you use. Just say that you used an AI tool. We did, but I don't know if that's material and if they're going to make us revise it as a result of that. The other thing is it doesn't really help where you maybe have a borderline question of whether something could be claimed or should be claimed as human authorship. And, for example, there are circumstances where the question hinges on how much human interaction there was with the AI tool. And I don't feel like that's adequately addressed in these descriptions. It doesn't help with gray areas. And the box on the online form is pretty, as well as the paper form, is pretty darn small. And there's no way to it that I can find to provide an attachment, except if you go into the comments and, like, see how many characters it'll allow you to put in there. Or I guess say, you know, contact us for more information or what have you. But the key tenets, I think, of what's in the new guidance are: identify that you've used AI, identify the human parts that you, the human generated parts that you are claiming, and identify the parts that you're excluding. And I think we've complied with that, but I still think it's possible we get a letter.
Can you do what I did in law school and just shrink or enlarge the font to fill the space that you need? Then they allow you to do that?
Wouldn't that be? I wish that we could, because that is no. It's just one of those online. Their online form is not user friendly.
Chris seems to be agreeing with you.
I was just gonna say two things. One, it's very user unfriendly. And what we did when we were trying to put this together is actually be descriptive about what went into the application. My publication date, I think, came out the day that they issued revised guidance on Chris's registration, and then a little bit later they issued this new stuff in the Federal Register. So I didn't have the benefit of it, but I was guessing where things were going. But I kept having to revise it because it was like this number of characters didn't fit, so it was kind of in the moment editing process. There is some degree of optimism that the Copyright Office has started a modernization process, and they've had, I think, typically twice a year, webinars where they show off kind of where they're headed. They have a number of people and a variety of interests represented there. It looks really cool. This is kind of your typical government project where the end result, I think, will be very admirable. The process by which we get there is probably about 24 months before there's a new system, if I understood their explanation correctly.
Well, good. It's about time they join the 21st century, right?
Yeah.
So. Yeah, we'll get there.
Well, Chris, I know we've kept you kind of hidden in the background while we're talking, but we are really excited to have you on because of your experience with your book, Zyra of the Dawn. And it's been through, I would say, like this pinball machine with the U.S. Copyright Office, where it was initially granted protection and now they've reversed themselves. And so, I mean, it's this back and forth. But let's start off at the beginning and have you talk about Zyra of the Dawn and the way that you created the story, you laid it out, the artwork, and, you know, what was the creative process that you used to create this?
So I wrote a story before AI became such a popular thing. And actually, there was no way for me to generate those images with AI because there were no tools that were available for public at the time. I think there was a waiting list to get OpenAI DALL-E. And I was on that waiting list for many months, and I only was able to use it when they went public and you could actually get it for money. So I actually, when I was writing a story, I wasn't aware of generative AI tools for images, and that's going to become such a big deal. It was 2021, very deep into the pandemic. I live in New York City. I live in Manhattan. So everything here was very streets were empty in 2020. And in 2021, things kind of started getting a bit better. But still, there was a lot of cases in the city. And I felt quite isolated. I didn't see my family for a very long time, and I lost my grandma who raised me. So I lost my best friend and then another best friend to cancer. Yeah. So it was a time of grief, and it was a time of feeling isolation. And I also was unemployed for quite a long time by then, because I am a professional photographer by trade. And I used to photograph sport and fitness and yoga. And my job required me to travel, or my clients to travel to New York, or to at least being able to meet people in person, which wasn't possible anymore. So unfortunately, all of my clients, even though they tried very hard, they couldn't really have any photography taken. So I was unemployed, and it was really hard. I was living on savings. My friends were helping me out immensely during this time. So I was in a very dark place. And then imagine this, August 2022, and I see these images coming on my Facebook feed of people who weren't particularly popular on social media. They didn't have a lot of following, because I remember that to get a DALI account, you had to be like either famous or an influencer or an AI researcher. But those were people I just knew, my friends who weren't famous in any way. And I see these incredible images, and some of them were writing, "This is my journey." And my first reaction was like, oh, wow, how did they get an invite? So I asked one of my great friends how she got an invite. And she said, oh, anyone can join. It's not very user-friendly, but you just go on the Discord and create yourself an account, and this is what you do. And she sent me the website link, and that completely took my pain away, because I was struggling. And also during that time, I had a dental surgery, quite like half of my face was swollen. And unfortunately, dentists didn't give me any fun medications. They just said, ibuprofen, you can take it, a lot of it. And I was in so much pain and distress. I just wanted something to take my mind off my losses, my surgical pain. And then I discovered Midjourney. For first 3 days, I generated pretty much everything I could think of. I wasn't making a story. I was just generating everything on my mind. And I live in New York. I really like Central Park and trees and nature. So I generated every corner of Central Park. Then I generated an organization I volunteer with, Backpacks for the Street. But the images were so ugly that I was so ashamed to show them to my friends who were volunteering with me, because it wasn't very good at generating humans in such a great detail, or especially few humans and an action.
Right.
But this was my 3 days, and I exhausted my imagination for all the images, and I thought, okay, now I generated everything. What's next? And that's when I remembered the story I wrote a year ago. And I thought, oh, that will be actually great, because I tried to illustrate it. I tried to use, I did self-portraits, and I was also learning 3D tools like Blender and Cinema 4D. So in 2021, I tried to illustrate my story with 3D and self-portraits. So I was just combining 3D worlds I was making in Blender, and then taking photos of myself and putting myself in. And I tried to like turn around so you can't really see face. It's just like my character, who was always available to pose for me, because it was me. And I had about 200 images because I did it every single day. But they weren't comic book quality because they weren't close-ups and they were more like a vast scene and a tiny, tiny human in the middle. So it's very hard to make a comic book out of such similar images. And then I was writing a story along with every image. So I already had the whole story and it was laid out. And the idea was that every single day I would create a different world. And all of those worlds were connected to my emotions. So they were like the worlds themselves were the way I felt on the particular day. And the world itself would help me to resolve that feeling. I take a lot of psychology courses. It's my biggest passion, psychology. So I was like, I'm going to share everything I learned so far that helps me as psychology tools through this narrative. And it was like a long story, long novel. And then when that happened, I was like, okay, I'll try to make one first chapter because the story is so long. So I had to kind of take just a tiny bit of it.
Right.
Yeah.
And that's how Zarya of the Dawn happened. And this is how like I started generating those images. Every single day I would write one page and I would share on social media. And I noticed how AI community was really supportive and just the reaction was so positive because I shared it in AI community groups. I'm like, wow, people love it so much. And then I thought, well, it will be great. My first thought was, well, maybe if I make the entire comic book, I can print it and offer it to people donation-based and raise some money for the charity I am volunteering with because it's very small and they always need money. And I did.
Yeah. It's really interesting because I think this is a story that you hear a lot, especially with artists, is that, you know, a lot of the greatest creations come from some, unfortunately, amount of pain, and that's the way that they're able to focus. It's why artists put out such great work, even when, you know, things are terrible with them. Well, let me ask you one thing about the online community, because I've got a few artists in my family, and when I talk about AI-generated art, sometimes I get a negative reaction. Did you have people that were coming from it from a different angle that was seeing it as a threat rather than another form of expression?
Oh, yeah. It's actually a very current topic.
I've seen it in the news quite a bit.
Yesterday on Twitter, I was compared to Hitler.
What?
Oh. Trying to copyright AI images. And it's quite painful because actually my great-grandfather was at concentration camp.
Oh my God.
He did survive and had a very long and very good life. He ran away, but...
Oh my God.
To hear such thing, and also from people who don't know me, and seeing this is still going on, because when I started in August, I was kind of a little bit sheltered because I had my Facebook groups of AI enthusiasts, and it was not that big, and people were just being excited. When I started sharing on my main page in Facebook, like a personal page, all of my friends photographers kind of divided into two groups. First one really wanted to learn it, and second one was completely against it. It almost felt there was no middle ground. And, you know, I come from software engineering background. I worked as a software engineer for 10 years. So it wasn't just my artistic side that was excited. It was also a computer scientist in me because I have master's in computer science. I worked as a programmer. And you know, when I was studying, it was 2002 to 2007, I did my master's. I thought that AI, we did have a subject that was called AI. It was the most boring subject.
Because nothing was happening at that point.
I took the same course.
It was so uninteresting to me. And I remember I always wanted to get good grades. So basically, pretty much, I learned it, passed an exam,
and forgot it.
And then
forgot
about
it. I only remember the
Been
book.
Yeah.
It was very thick. It had artificial intelligence writing on it, and it was no pictures, just text.
Yeah.
And it was large. It was huge. And now when I think about it, I think, oh, if I could have a time machine, I would read it. I would read every single word because I am interested where things were back then. But right now it's so exciting and it's so amazing. But I think computer scientist in me was rejoicing. I was like, oh, wow, this is happening. And because I also have understanding of algorithms and how it works and how the program, how it operates, it blew my mind on so many levels. And to be honest, I am quite saddened that it keeps happening, the harassment and bullying. And some people say, oh, you can't call harassment or bullying just if people have different opinion. But that's not true.
That's not what's happening.
That's not what, happening there. I mean, that wasn't a...
It's Hitler. It's writing death threats, and not just to me. AI comic book writers got a lot of death threats. So I think it kind of crossed the line at this point. And I feel like as different tools come out, this is what happens. Things were pretty okay. It was not perfect when it was just Midjourney. As soon as Lensa released those self-portraits, that was the first time the level of harassment was so high. I honestly didn't know what to do. It was around before Christmas, and it lasted from like a few weeks before and then all the way into Christmas. And I was thinking, well, this is a very uncomfortable situation because everyone knows my home address because of the copyright office who revealed it to the entire planet. And I am being harassed and so in such a way. So I really felt a bit strange about it. But, you know, there is a positive side about it because one day I get this beautiful package in my mail and I open it and I couldn't believe it. Roger sent me a card and then he sent me a comic book about like Edgar Allan Poe. And he also wrote me about Edgar Allan Poe because I didn't know that he lived in Bronx. And I also didn't know he was being harassed when he was alive. So I was like, wow. So, you know, every medal has two sides. So yes, it was harassment, but also so much kindness, so much support, so many new friends and connections. Also, some people who were quite extreme about AI now writing me and say, well, don't tell anyone I use AI, but can you tell me how to do this?
I want to do all the cool stuff you're doing without being referred to as some awful person.
See, now you're the expert and people are going to use. So, you know, speaking of that, I know that Zarya of the Dawn was, you know, we talked about you were using Midjourney to generate that artwork. But now your newer creation, Rose Enigma, is using Stable Diffusion and a different AI generation tool with the combination of your old pencil drawings. So how is this style different from what you did on Zarya of the Dawn?
So, well, I am an artist. I make a lot of handmade stuff. I make claymations. One of my biggest passion and dreams is to make a sculpture out of garbage materials, like recycled materials. and take that creation to Burning Man. And I built some in my apartment.
That's cool. I just read a fiction book by Ruth Uzbeki that dealt with art made of garbage. So that's just a thing.
I need to read that.
I'll send it to you.
How many things you can make? I saw this incredible artist in Portugal. He makes out of like metal, like cars and stuff like this. Mine is a bit modest. It's just like everything we throw away. I had one sculpture made of boxes, like milk boxes and like stuff like that. And I made my mind out. It was like a big construction, like little houses, and then it had lots of light in it, and then I made a dragon out of CDs. I got some old CDs from eBay, and then I cut them out, like I made triangles out of them, like thousands. I did have time during the pandemic, as you can see. I was bored, so I could spend weeks cutting those CDs. And then I sticked them. I made a sculpture out of papier-mâché, and I made a quite nice dragon out of this iridescent like material. So this was like something I do. I am always dreamt to be good at drawing since I was born. And I was born in North Caucasus in USSR. And my family was so poor, but they did try to bring me an education. And there was an art school in our village. And one day I went there with a friend in secret. I just sneaked in. I was like 8 years old and I just sneaked in. And my friend told me, oh, they won't notice extra child. And it is like proper school. It had like easels and paints and a watercolor and everything. And it was the happiest day of my life. Mm-hmm. And then when I got back home, my grandma was completely mad because she lost me for the entire day. I was away the entire day. She didn't know where I was because there were no cell phones. We didn't tell that's going to happen. And she was freaking out. And she was so angry, and she told me where I went. And I said, well, I went to art school with my friend Lena, and I want to go to this art school. I want to draw. That's all I want. And my grandma, she was a very kind woman, even though she did get really mad at me, but she was very kind. And she said, yeah, let's try to make it work.
Nice.
And unfortunately, she couldn't. We didn't have money, so I couldn't go. And the school asked us to pay for the entire year, and it was already like end of semester. So my grandma was like, we don't have money like at all. We could have paid for maybe 1 month, the one that is left, but not the entire year. But because of a lot of people did that school just to get like a certificate or some kind of thing that they could study later, and it was like a 8 years long school. It was like a proper art school. It just didn't work. And I remember I was so sad, but also I knew that she will be sad if I show that I'm so sad. I was like, okay, I'll just focus on earning money, growing up, getting a job, earning enough money, and going back to art school. But the problem was that my entire life I spent doing math and physics, and I didn't have much time to practice. So my drawing skills stayed the same as it was when I was 8 years old. And for many years, I did try to take classes, I did try to get good at it. But you know, when you do something commercially like photography or something, you just don't have time to develop another skill to take this time out of work. So it always stayed on the back of my mind, oh, and I was good. When I was 8, I was really good. But now I'm not. I couldn't be a commercial painter. Yeah. For sure not.
Yeah.
Well, last summer I taught a class on the art of Burning Man and intellectual property. And I have been part of teams that built art at Burning Man and installations at Burning Man. So if you want to talk about that offline, let me know.
Yeah.
Hell, I want to talk about that.
Yeah, too. So to continue this, I want to mention that even though I haven't developed my drawing skills because I didn't have time, I do still have ideas of how I want those things to look in my head. So I know how I want it to be drawn, and I can draw in some way, but it's never the vision I have in my head, the idea I have in my head is very hard to make with me drawing. I can make it through photography. I got pretty good at Photoshop and taking photographs and making like collages out of it to show it in such way. But to draw in such way, unfortunately, I probably could if I did it full time for maybe 5 years. But I'm 37 years old and I have other things that responsibilities. So I can't just drop everything and spend this time learning how to draw. So for me, I was looking for tools how to do that. And you know, first when I just joined AI community Midjourney, I tried. There was a way to draw, put your drawing into Midjourney and see what happens. But the results weren't good back in August. It was nothing like my drawing. It would just do something with it. It would almost use it like, you know, it would take my drawing, take one color out of it, and somehow arrange the image. It wasn't controlled in any way. It didn't look like my drawing, so there was no point of me trying to draw something. But a few weeks ago, Stable Diffusion, which it's possible to use completely free on your own computer, released this control net, which is a way to direct the model. And you can do a lot with it. For example, you can generate something like a person, and you can make a doll that kind of a puppet shows the pose, and it will be exactly like the pose you made. You can put an image like a sketch, and then you can generate something that resembles your sketch, and you can direct it. You can say what exactly you want with your sketch as a reference.
It's interesting here to hear you describe the process and the advances in the tools, sort of adapting more to both your intentions and the direction you're going. I almost wonder if there's an analogy to music, which is if you use something like auto-tune or reverb or production, facilities, you say, well, I can't sing, but I have lots of techniques and lots of technology that makes me a better singer.
Yeah.
If I were to apply for copyright for the sound recording, I wouldn't have to disclaim and explain all of the audio, amplification and sort of tuning techniques that I have. It seems odd that like there's this approach to saying, well, you need to do all of these things in AI, and especially Midjourney 3 and 4 and a little bit into 5, well, you don't have a lot of control over it, so we're not going to really give you much there. Yeah. But it's nice to see Stable Diffusion's models kind of evolving into a way where you both have more control, and also your vision can be something that's not accidental but intentional.
Yeah, and I think one of the things that you're seeing, and I'm kind of realizing this firsthand, is that being able to use the AI tools, at least as they are, in March and April of 2023, that the skill set to be a great writer or a skill set to be a great artist don't necessarily run parallel lines to what it means to use these tools to create great writing or to create great drawings or images. It's a different part of the brain, I think. It's probably still on that right side, artistic side of the brain, but it's different. It's a lot more about being able to describe what it is that you want to do rather than just do what you want to do, which a lot of times I think with artists, they're trained in order to kind of take a vision in their head and then take that and make the art out of it, and not necessarily I don't think they could necessarily, before they start, describe exactly what it is that they're going to output. It's kind of a process. And to bring it back to the law, the biggest obstacle that I'm seeing for lawyers and AI tools to advance their ability to practice, to streamline some of the things they do, is this is a different way. They have to retrain their brain to think differently about how the tools approach. And to me, it was very frustrating. I even had a tweet out this week that I was a little frustrated because the lack of creativity and imagination that I'm seeing is really hampering where I think people could benefit from it. But, you know, I might just have to tone that down a little bit on my side, because it is a retraining. And if that's not a part of the brain that you're used to relying on to do your job, it makes it really hard to kind of figure out how can I leverage this great tool to make what I do even better.
As you were saying, and talking about in legal technology, to take that bridge, you know, Roger and I have talked about and we've talked about it with our law school too, and we've added courses about thinking about design and systems thinking, because you're thinking about the process.
I also, even though, those guidelines are a bit vague, but to be honest, this is the first time in history such a revolution is happening. And I think because the tools are evolving so fast, like literally every minute we are talking, I'm pretty sure I will check my news after this talk and there will be new tools and new algorithms and new stuff. So I feel the best we can do right now is to educate the copyright office, because their job isn't to learn every AI technology. They probably don't have an AI consultant. I would love to be an AI consultant for them if they need to, but I feel like they already have other tasks. And if we can lay out those tools for them in a way like the lawyer would explain it, because I wanted to do it by myself, because I can explain very well how I do, but I do it as a computer scientist. What I realized is that what seems very obvious to me isn't obvious to maybe lawyers. So that's why I wrote on LinkedIn and I said I'm looking for a pro bono lawyer to help me write this cover letter. And I was really lucky, because not only I got a pro bono lawyer, the lawyers who were working with them, they were interested in tech. And I spent hours explaining technology, showing all the new things I'm using in my process. And they spoke the same language, because it's one of those things that I don't know, it will keep evolving. And artists also need to have a way to understand what is copyrightable and what is not. And right now, the guidelines are just so vague. I personally feel that those images I created in Zara and Vudon, even though I did not draw them, it wasn't like a slot machine. Mm-hmm. It was the prompting, the process of me. Those prompts were very long because it was old version. So there was creativity in me making those prompts and directing it. Also, it wasn't just random output. I was directing it. I didn't get like cats and dogs and clouds and food. No, I got exactly what I wanted and how I wanted it through modification of those prompts. But what I understood is just difficult for them to grasp it. So I want to show all the possible technology right now. And maybe one day we will have images, just text to images, copyrightable in some way.
What's interesting, hearing you describe the process, Chris, there's a class action lawsuit that's been filed in, I believe, the Northern District of California. There's three artists representing it. They're suing Stable Diffusion, Midjourney, and I think DeviantArt. And one thing that's in kind of the explanatory part of the complaint is they're trying to describe this as if the process of using AI tools was like querying a database. They said, you're searching for things and they're there and you're getting output. But I think that really misses the mark in terms of both what was happening even for the versions of those tools at the time, but also just generally what's happening. And also the other piece of it on the stable diffusion model is that the large corpus of information that's in a lot of these tools is, you know, multiple terabytes. And it's not that you're querying to get a copy of something like you are from Google Images. You're creating something that's an idea of an apple or an idea of a tree and how it's shaping that in terms of kind of morphing things together.
Yeah,
it didn't exist before. The only way for you to create exactly the same image as I did is the process I described in my copyright letter for Rose Enigma, because I revealed to you my seed, and that's a very big number, and I revealed every single setting I used. And the thing is, it's quite similar if I was making a photograph and I would reveal to you the location, the model, time of the day, lighting, and all the settings I used in my camera. You could potentially create a photograph just like mine, but normally photographers don't do it. So it's not like I'm planning to reveal seeds and everything for everyone, but I just wanted to show that if you put all those parameters, the same prompt that I created in my mind, you will keep getting exactly the same image. You can all recreate it with your stable diffusion. So it's not random. It's not like it came from something out there. And there is limited amount of images you can create. It's just the number is so large.
Yeah.
Because you can change a prompt just one letter and a different seed, it will be something else. But it is a limited number. It's not indefinite if you kind of think of math and stuff like this, because the prompt also has a limited number of tokens you can use. It's just so big that probably, I don't know, it's not possible to change.
And one thing that's interesting in some of the guidance that seems to come out, or one way to interpret, is that, you know, there's a little bit of a requirement of show your work. Like, you know, tell us what you use, tell us the tools and things, which I really appreciate the approach that the attorneys at Morrison Foerster took to be very deliberate about that. But, you know, we learned from, there's this case that went to the Supreme Court involving the white pages, so telephone directories. And the basic premise to that is copyright does not come from human labor. It comes from creativity. So it's not that you put more work into it, so you therefore get copyright, or you put less work into it and you don't. So there's this, what's called the sweat of the brow doctrine. And I think it's an interesting tension between show more of your work and, well, the more work you do doesn't necessarily mean you get better protection.
Yeah. And Ashley and Roger, and Chris as well, going forward, you know, how should people who are creating, you know, doing this and are looking for copyright protection, because I imagine, you know, Roger, you mentioned auto-tune. I imagine there was probably some talk at the time that things that are auto-tuned maybe are not artistic, are not at a level. Or you can look at Photoshop. I know when, was it Image Comics or one of the comics that started using actual computer programs to draw their comics and color their comics. Was that somehow less artistic than, you know, the pen, the pencil and pen and ink? So I imagine we go through these stages as the technology advances and there's a change in the way that things are produced. And again, like you said, Roger, it's not necessarily about the amount of human labor, but rather the creative process that's involved, that is what is the reason that IP law is built into the Constitution, is we want to have this incentive for people to create. How do you see this evolving, you know, as we go forward?
Do you want to go first, Ashley, or do you want me to?
I'm still thinking, but one of the things I would say is, like, this goes back to that, and you will remember the name of the case, Roger, because I still can't remember the name of the case, about the camera and whether photographs were copyrightable.
Right. This is Burrough-Giles. So this is the question of whether or not somebody should be granted protection for a photograph of Oscar Wilde, because the claim at the time was that the constitutional origins are that it protects writings, and a photograph is not a writing. At least that was the argument, and thankfully, before they actually put it in Section 101 of Title 17 of the U.S. Code, they said, no, actually, this is a writing. Okay, we can get there.
Okay.
It's not even that big of a mental leap to go there.
Interesting.
Roger, you're going to launch a course in 2023 called Comics in the Law, where you'll work with your students to actually make comic books using AI, Creative Commons resources, and, you know, their own creativity to create access to justice-themed comics. That sounds like something that I would want to audit. So,
yeah.
You know, what's the goal of this course, and what value do you think students and others might get out of enrolling in the course?
Fantastic. I love talking about this, and I'm so excited about this.
Well, this is cool because I thought about this in terms of the comic that you sent, in terms of different ways of learning. And I mean, I thought about, like, I'm going to show this to my kids and see if, like, they can ingest that more quickly. Yeah. So the fact that it's a graphic novel.
Well, since you mentioned that, Marlene, I want to just point out that when I was a kid, the thing that got me most interested in reading was comic books.
Yeah.
I was not a great reader, but it was something that I picked up. It was something that I had an English teacher who let me run with that. There's great value in having different styles of teaching a topic that it, based on the students that you have. So, sorry, Roger, I didn't mean to
take away from
your answer there.
No, that's great. No, so I'll give a couple of examples of the kind of things that I think are both inspiring to me, and then talk a little bit about where I think students should go and we should be thinking about this. If you look at something like LawToons, there's LawToons and LawToons 2. It's from somebody who lives in the Netherlands at The Hague, and this was developed as a way to create a comic book to help kids understand the law better. And I talked at some length with the person who put this together. It's a fascinating project to look at. And she was very specific that they wanted to think, how do we make it so that law is more understandable and accepted in terms of, like, a foundational element of society? So it's a really interesting thing there. And there's both a really cool comic out of it and a fair amount of academic research that's gone into it. And another example of things that I've seen that I've been really inspired by are materials that come out of the Harvard Access to Justice Lab, or A to J Lab. What they're doing is they're using things such as 1- and 2-page comics that explain to people how to respond to a summons. And instead of putting it in dense language of long narrative paragraphs, it's a 4- to 6-panel comic that shows somebody getting a letter, opening it, a specific number of days that you have to do something with it, and putting it in the envelope. And sitting behind all that, they have empirical studies that really measures all of the outputs and all of the achievements that they have. I want to take our students and jump to the end of it, which is tell a story about access to justice, tell a story about a legal process or something important to society, and develop the narrative storytelling features of it so you can get there. My counterpart is a big fan of there's a couple of books by Linda Barry that are about making comics, and Scott McCloud does some as well, that are the narrative style of pen to paper. So anybody can be an artist, will do that. I've been inspired by the AI tools. It says anybody can have an idea, and there's a various number of tools that you can use to get there. So it's going to be a combination of all those. And there's two requirements. Come with an open mind and create one comic as an output that connects to justice.
Yeah, I definitely want to audit this class now.
Yeah, me too.
Absolutely.
Well, Ashley and Chris, we ask all of our guests what we call our crystal ball question. And Roger, feel free to chime in here as well if you want. What do you think? I know we're just at the beginning stages of this combination of humanity and AI when it comes to creativity. I mean, just in Chris's story between August of last year and now, there's been this just enormous amount of change. And like they said, we go check our email, there's going to be something new in there this afternoon that wasn't there this morning. So where do you think, you know, when it comes to the issue of what will deserve copyright protection, where do you think we're headed in the next, you know, 2 to 5 years? And Ashley, I'll let you start off if you don't mind.
Oh, sure. I'm happy to start. You know, I think ultimately that the Copyright Office is going to have to recognize that these are tools that people use for creative expression, just like 100 years ago, the camera was another tool for creative expression. Just like auto-tune, like Roger mentioned, you know, there are so many examples of a director putting together a movie, telling an actor how to deliver the line. There are just so many ways where we recognize creativity that uses tools that is not simply pen on paper, that I think that it's inevitable that they're going to have to recognize this.
And Chris, where do you think we're going the next two to five years?
Is it 2 to 5 years?
That may be too far off.
You know,
2 to 5 months.
I'm thinking about it every day. And you know what? I'm known for first being too optimistic in general. That comes from my grandma, who went through war, famine, and she was still so positive. So, and she raised me. So it's like we lived in a conflict zone, and I still was like, yeah, this is a bombshell, but we're going to have a great fun and like a shelter. So, you know, it's like, it's just my attitude, even though it is a very like difficult time for AI creators right now. But you know what I think? I want to believe that, first of all, this technology has a great potential to cure disease. One of my biggest focuses on AI now is how can we use AI to fix climate change? Also accessibility. The fact that we created this comic book was because my younger brother has special needs. He loves comic books, but it's very hard for him to read. He has very severe ADHD. And I thought I will create a comic book that he can actually read, because he always told me, you read books, you shall write a book. And once I asked him, I said, but will you read it? And he said, no, but I want you to be happy and to make it. He's 16 years old now. And I thought, well, he can read a comic book. So I made this comic book. It was translated on over 30 languages, including Greek, which is the language my brother speaks. Huh? He's my half-brother. And I dedicated it to him. So for people like him, it's accessibility and also like creating images. Not a lot of people can draw just due to their physical limitations. That's why Rose Enigma isn't going to be my last. So for me, it's also accessibility. So I feel like in maybe 5 years, this thing will become a norm. And hopefully the harassment wave also subside. Because I don't know if you've heard, but just a few days ago, Adobe launched Firefly, which is a text-to-image generation and also font generation. And they trained the model, and the model is trained on royalty-free content they have license for. So it's like the most ethical model that exists right now. And Adobe is very focused on creators, so they definitely will compensate every creator involved in this. It's one of those companies who really cares. So I feel it's just the start.
Yep.
There will be more companies who do it in the same way. So the ethical part will be resolved. And yeah, I feel like it's a beautiful thing. There definitely will be like growing pains and stuff like this, but hopefully we'll overcome it. We are creatives, we're adaptable, and in 5 years, it will be just a thing that we use to make our life easier.
All right. Roger?
I was going to say, I'm not going to go into detail about predictions, but one of the last things that Chris mentioned, I think, is something we're going to see play out, which is companies that take an approach to incorporating tools where there's a greater amount of clarity around what is allowed to be used. I love this idea of Adobe's Firefly, where they're training it on things that have a very specific risk profile to them, which is nearly zero, or things they've paid for.
Uh-huh.
I've heard from somebody who works in the music industry where they think that there may be a direction that happens with that as well, where somebody owns the music rights for a corpus of materials. You could kind of play in the space, and then what you're doing is you're interacting with things they have licensed.
Right.
At the end is a question of what's the ownership piece of that? Is a contractual thing that runs to them as a subscriber or not? But I do think that there's going to be a movement in the direction of maybe a little bit more clear sort of rights to the particular elements that are underlying these creative tools.
Very cool. Well, I'm excited to see where we're headed on this.
So thank you all for coming on and talking to us. Chris, how can people find you and your work online?
I publish a lot of free educational material. I make AI tutorials and I make explainers and all kinds of things. And it's on my website, which is very easy to remember. It's chris.art. Also, I'm quite active on Twitter, where I feel like my community who uses AI is growing and thriving.
Roger and Ashley, other than your professor profiles at the University of Richmond Law School, where should our listeners go to find you online and learn more about your efforts?
I continue to be on Twitter. I'm mostly at this point a reader, less so of a contributor, but by all means, I find that a place that still has opportunities for engagement. And certainly my professor profile. I'd love to connect with somebody. I'd love to think about, publishing this work more widely and thinking about new opportunities for developing, especially educational materials and things like that.
And for me, Ashley R. Dobbs is my name on LinkedIn, or my professor profile. Those are probably the best ways to find me. The university also maintains a YouTube channel where they have professors giving short explanations of law issues in the news, and it's called the synopsis. So you can also find me there explaining things like why Cardi B can't get a trademark for Au Cour.
Well,
I need to know.
I'm not going right now.
Law school YouTubes could be so exciting.
Yeah.
Yeah.
All right. Well, thank you all for being here.
Thank you so much.
Thank you. Bye.
And of course, thanks to all of you for taking the time to listen to the Geek & Review podcast. If you enjoy the show, share it with a colleague. We'd love to hear from you, so reach out to us on social media. I can be found at GabeauerM on Twitter.
And I can be reached at Glambert on Twitter.
Or you can leave us a voicemail on the Geek & Review hotline at 713-487-7821. And as always, the music you hear is from Jerry David DeSica. Thank you, Jerry.
Thanks, Jerry. All right, Marlene, I will talk to you later.
All right, bye.